that was taking place on a day-to-day basis.
And, of course, the consent form was in English. While they lost the lawsuit, this wasn't before a jury, but before one judge, a white male judge. Yes. Talk about the changes that resulted from the bravery of these women coming forward.
It really rallied the community. You had protests. You had the newspaper covering this issue at a time that it didn't really cover the ethnic Mexican community. You had a waiting period implemented so that it became illegal to approach a woman while she was in labor regarding tubal ligation. So a 72 waiting period wasn't implemented. You also had recommendations or legislation put into place that required consent forms be in the language of the patient. So some of those were monumental changes that occurred because of this lawsuit.
Well, Virginia,
and because these women came forward.
We have to leave it there, but we encourage people to see this amazing documentary. Producer and lead historian for the film No Mas Babies, No More Babies. Lecturer with UCLA Department of Chicano and Central American Studies. The film aired on PBS Independent Lens in 2016. Is now available on demand on Vimeo in both English and Spanish. We will link to it. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe, wear a mask, save lives.
You're tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Your investment in community radio can go on with a planned gift to KBOO. Consider adding KBOO to your will or add KBOO as a beneficiary to your insurance and bank accounts. You can change your mind anytime if your circumstances change. But recognizing KBOO along with your family and friends in your legacy giving is a powerful commitment to media justice. Let us know if you add KBOO to your plans. We'd like to thank you for your considerate future gift. Contact us at 503-231-8032. Or email development@kboo.fm to notify us of your plans.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, Proud Boys, the hate group planning a rally this Saturday, run into permitting difficulties. President Trump issued an executive order yesterday on combating race and sex stereotyping, and a grand jury in Kentucky has refused to find the three officers who murdered Breonna Taylor guilty. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, September 23rd, 2020. KBOO is currently in our membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Althea Billings. On Wednesday, the Oregon Health Authority reported 193 new cases of COVID-19, bringing the total number of cases in the state up to 31,503. Oregon health officials also reported 6 new deaths, raising the state death toll to 538 people. An incarcerated man died on Monday in Oregon after testing positive for COVID-19. He is the 7th prisoner in Oregon to die from the virus. Lane County is experiencing an uptick in cases as students return to classes at the University of Oregon. 48 new cases were reported today, bringing the county to a total of 1,071 coronavirus cases. More than 6.9 million people in the U.S. have been infected with the virus. The U.S. death toll from the coronavirus topped 200,000 on Tuesday, and today has already reached 201,573. The bleak milestone is the highest confirmed death toll from the virus in the world. Over the past week, there have been an average of about 41,800 cases per day, an increase of 7% from the average we were seeing 2 weeks earlier. According to the CDC, the majority of COVID-19 deaths during the early months of the pandemic occurred in communities with lower incomes and denser populations of people of color. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 31.7 million people in nearly every country. At least 972,900 people have died worldwide. Proud Boys, which are a designated hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center, are planning a protest on this Saturday, September 26th. KBOO's Nat Moon has more on the story.
The city of Portland today refused to issue a permit to the hate group Proud Boys for a planned march at Delta Park on Saturday. The city's Park Bureau, in coordination with Mayor Ted Wheeler, found that the estimated 10,000 attendees ran counter to preventing the spread of COVID-19. The Proud Boys, a white supremacist, anti-Muslim, anti-Semitic, racist, homophobic, and misogynistic group established in 2016 and self-described as, quote, Western chauvinists, are classified as a hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center. The rally was originally planned to take place at Terry Schrunk Plaza in downtown Portland, where the Proud Boys are known to hold gatherings, often attracting many anti-fascist counter-protesters. The change to Delta Park was made due to, quote, a battalion of patriots who are ready to exercise their constitutionally protected right to assemble. The Portland Police Bureau released a statement yesterday regarding two protests planned in the city of Portland, organized by groups with, quote, differing ideologies. One of those events is, of course, the Proud Boy rally. The other is an anti-fascist mutual aid event and demonstration taking place at Peninsula Park from noon to 3 p.m. on Saturday. This is not the first time the Portland police have specifically declined to condemn white supremacy. City commissioners, as well as Mayor Wheeler, have stated that the Proud Boys and other far-right groups are not welcome in Portland and have urged counter-protesters to also abstain from protesting on that day. As Commissioner Chloe Udaly said regarding the Proud Boys today, quote, deny them what they want, an audience. Many, though, call for deplatforming those that actively advocate for violence against systemically oppressed groups. Mark Bray, a professor at Rutgers University, wrote, quote, it is incumbent upon us to do what we can to prevent such groups from growing. The spectacle of shutting down fascists may give them more attention in the short term, but such actions deprive them of the ability to capitalize on that attention. Reporting for KBOO, I'm Nat Moon.
Yesterday, President Trump issued an executive order on combating race and sex stereotyping. In response to workplace diversity trainings across the country and within the federal government, Trump's executive order says it will be, quote, the policy of the United States not to promote race or sex stereotyping or scapegoating in the federal workforce or in the uniformed services, and not to allow grant funds to be used for those purposes. The executive order will not permit federal contractors to teach these views to employees either. In his order, Trump provides 9 specific examples of divisive concepts, along with general definitions of stereotyping and scapegoating in relation to race or sex, which can no longer be taught. The examples and definitions provided are broad enough that they could likely be used to stop any and all diversity training within the federal government. The introduction for the executive order includes a selective history of the United States, tying together positive and patriotic aspects from the Declaration of Independence, the Civil War, and the Civil Rights Movement. It then paints a contradictory picture of a modern America that is battling with the following destructive ideology. It reads, quote, that men and members of certain races, as well as our most venerable institutions, are inherently sexist or racist, are appearing in workplace diversity trainings across the country, even in components of the federal government and among federal contractors. Including example quotes from a 19th century slavery apologist, Trump infers that his destructive ideology is aimed at white men. The executive order comes a little over a month before Election Day, further dividing the platforms presented by the Trump and Biden campaigns. With the new executive order, President Trump and VP Mike Pence paint an America where some have taken steps towards diversity and inclusion too far. Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden and his VP pick Kamala Harris are themselves a more diverse team. They include diversity and inclusion in their Build Back Better agenda to advance racial equity in the United States. A Kentucky grand jury today indicted Brett Hankison, one of the 3 Louisville police officers involved in the murder of Breonna Taylor 6 months ago. The other 2 officers, including Detective Miles Cosgrove, whose weapon the FBI has confirmed fired the fatal shot, were not indicted. Hankison was indicted on 3 counts of first-degree wanton endangerment, which is a Class D felony and carries a penalty of 1 to 5 years in prison. Importantly, the charges refer to the endangerment of the apartment building and Breonna Taylor's neighbors, not her murder directly. Attorney General Daniel Cameron said the two other officers involved in the shooting, Cosgrove, as I mentioned earlier, and Sergeant Jonathan Mattingly, were justified in their use of force. The three officers fired more than 24 bullets at Taylor's apartment. In anticipation of Cameron's announcement, Louisville Mayor Greg Fisher invoked a 72-hour curfew, effective Wednesday night, from 9 p.m. to 6:30 a.m. When the indictment was announced, a group of around 200 protesters gathered in downtown Louisville and began chanting, quote, "No justice, no peace." Thousands are expected to gather in Louisville as the night continues, with solidarity marches planned around the country. The women's rights group Ultraviolet said of the indictment today, quote, "There will be no justice until all of the officers who killed Breonna are held accountable for her murder." Last night, President Donald Trump says he wants to quickly fill the Supreme Court vacancy created by Ruth Bader Ginsburg's death so he can use the court to challenge the results of the upcoming election. He said, quote, "We need 9 justices. With the unsolicited millions of ballots that they're sending, it's a scam. It's a hoax." The president's re-election campaign and the National Republican Party have budgeted millions of dollars to make legal challenges against mail-in voting during the pandemic. Other voter suppression methods, like cutting registration rolls and severely restricting the number of voting machines in certain areas, have been ongoing for many months. Senate Republicans on the Judiciary Committee met yesterday to plan how quickly they can approve the nominee Trump will announce on Saturday, with a hearing potentially beginning the week of October 12th. An electoral precedent was set in 2000 when the Supreme Court declared George W. Bush the winner of the election in Florida and handed him the presidency despite controversy over votes there. Public land advocates are meeting with lawmakers this week about legislation that's meant to safeguard more than 1 million acres in California. Suzanne Potter with the Public News Service has more on the story.
People who fight for public lands are taking part in a major push this week, meeting with lawmakers about legislation called the Protecting America's Wilderness Act. The bill would safeguard more than 1 million acres across the Golden State. Jack Dyer with Topa Topa Brewing Company in Ventura says his business depends on outdoor enthusiasts drawn to the Los Padres National Forest.
People tend to enjoy beer after they've gone on a hike or gone on a mountain bike ride or gone fishing. All those things help my business, and preserving those open spaces, without them, I don't think our business would thrive.
This week, Dyer and almost a dozen others are holding a series of online meetings with members of Congress to ask that the bill be prioritized. It already passed the U.S. House in February, so now it's up to the Senate to act. The measure contains several standalone bills that protect lands and rivers on the Central Coast, in parts of Northwest California, and in the San Gabriel Mountains. Thomas Wong, board member of the San Gabriel Valley Water District, says it's especially critical that mountains behind L.A. be well managed, and this year's devastating wildfires underscore that point.
The San Gabriel Valley relies on the rain and snow that falls in the San Gabriel Mountains for the majority of our water supply. We want to make sure we preserve the natural spaces of the watershed.
Wong adds that heavily populated, lower-income communities also need better access to nature, and the pandemic has emphasized that need. In addition, he notes, the wildlife that inhabits public lands is even more dependent now on wildlife corridors as climate change affects their habitat. Support for this reporting was provided by the Pew Charitable Trusts. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You are listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In Depth. We will be listening to an excerpt of the launch of the Yes for Police Accountability campaign regarding Portland ballot measure 26217. Then at 5:45, we'll hear news from the Boo, your look at the news inside KBOO. Stick around at 6, we'll hear the Underground, and then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather, we'll see mostly cloudy skies and a chance of showers. Be expecting a low of 58. And tomorrow we can expect rain with a high of 66. Today in history, in 1941, activist George Jackson was born. While serving a sentence for stealing $70 from a gas station in 1961, he became involved in revolutionary activity and co-founded the Marxist-Leninist guerrilla family. The quote of the day is from Stokely Carmichael, a prominent figure during the civil rights and Pan-African movements. He said, quote, "Dr. King's policy was, if you are nonviolent, if you suffer, your opponent will see you suffering and will be moved to change his heart. That's very good. He only made one fallacious assumption. In order for nonviolence to work, your opponent must have a conscience. The United States has none." Arizona Governor Doug Ducey recently signed a proclamation recognizing Indigenous Peoples Day on the federal Columbus Day holiday. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Arizona Governor Doug Ducey announced Tuesday he signed a proclamation to recognize October 12, 2020 as Indigenous Peoples Day on the federal Columbus holiday. Emma Gibson with Arizona Public Media has more.
The proclamation came after Arizona State Senator James Sita Pashlakai and a youth-led advocacy group, Indigenous Peoples Initiative, called for the change. Dylan Baca, the group's president, who is White Mountain Apache and Navajo, says Indigenous Peoples Day acknowledges a more accurate account of Christopher Columbus's violent legacy.
This holiday is significant for me because it works to try to eliminate the stereotypes and stigmatisms associated with Indigenous peoples and tribes.
Pashlakai called on Governor Ducey in June during President Donald Trump's visit to Phoenix to establish the state holiday using his executive powers. She now says she will introduce a bill to permanently change the holiday in the 2021 legislative session. For National Native News, I'm Emma Gibson.
The Navajo Nation is returning to 57-hour weekend lockdowns and stay-at-home orders due to a rise in positive COVID-19 cases on and near the reservation. Tuesday's announcement comes a day after top U.S. infectious disease expert Dr. Anthony Fauci praised the tribe for lowering numbers, crediting the tribe's strict COVID-19 measures, which were enforced for months. Some of the orders, including the 57-hour curfew, were eased, but during a virtual town hall Tuesday, Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez had a stern message for residents to stay vigilant. Nez says a cluster of 40 or more positive cases trace back to travel and spreading the virus during social gatherings, which are currently restricted on Navajo land.
And so we're going to have to slow everything down. We're going to have to put stay-at-home orders because we don't know how far this has gone out in contact with other people.
The new cases were reported in Arizona and New Mexico. The tribe's also asking residents to avoid areas in Utah considered hotspots for the virus. Native Vote advocates encouraged young people to engage in the voting process on National Voter Registration Day. Barb Hartzell works with the Las Vegas Indian Center on the Native Vote. She talked about investing in Native youth by using traditional teachings and connecting them with issues Native youth face today.
Really taking like our traditional routes and how we carry ourselves and what is important to us and being able to invest that in our youth and meeting them where they're at and letting them really understand that it seems so big and so massive, or maybe it doesn't seem important at all. It really does determine a lot of things, and like it really determines just how far we've come from just our grandmothers and mothers' generations to where we'll go with their next generations.
Hartzell took part in a National Congress of American Indians virtual gathering Tuesday, along with tribal leaders and Native women in office. The organization's nonpartisan vote campaign focuses on education, registration, getting out the Native vote, election protection, and data collection. According to NCAI, an estimated 1.2 million American Indian and Alaska Native people are unregistered. Five Indian country bills were passed by Congress Tuesday and sent to the president to be signed into law. The bills address missing and murdered Indigenous women, self-governance, business, and economic development, and legislation to nullify a supplemental treaty for tribes on the Warm Springs Reservation. There are seven other bills currently pending in the House, which range from education to water rights and veterans issues. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A new study jointly researched by the University of North Carolina Greensboro, Indiana University, the University of Washington, and Davidson College shows that reopening colleges, particularly with in-person classes, has caused an increase in coronavirus cases. Researchers matched cell phone data with county infection rates for 1,400 schools, nearly 900 of which are doing primarily in-person classes. Reopening a university added 1.7 new infections per day per 100,000 people in a county, and teaching classes in person caused a 2.4% daily rise in cases. Schools with students who came from places with higher incidence of COVID-19 saw an additional rise in daily cases. The study says, quote, "No such increase is observed in counties with no colleges, closed colleges, or those that open primarily online." Professor Anna Bento is an infectious disease expert at Indiana University. She said of the report, quote, "While this study estimates around a 3,000 increase in daily cases, we have to take into account that this is actually likely an underestimate because we still don't see people who are asymptomatic." Surprising some, Utah Senator Mitt Romney supports putting Trump's upcoming Supreme Court nominee to a vote. With more on the story, it's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
So you're going to need 9 justices up there. I think it's going to be very important.
President Donald Trump made clear yesterday that one of his motivations for a quick Supreme Court appointment is the potential of an onslaught of legal battles during what will likely be an election season, not an election day. Again, despite decades of evidence, Trump falsely claimed mail-in voting is a, quote, scam and a, quote, hoax. A third Trump-appointed justice raises fears the highest court would bend the scale towards his re-election in those lawsuits. But a conservative majority court is what many Trump supporters are waiting for, including Ron Bishop, Wisconsin GOP chair for Wipon County.
The fact that he's appointed really good judges and justices is the main reason I can support him for re-election.
Utah Senator Mitt Romney said he favors putting Trump's nominee to a vote. In protest, Senate Democrats cut short a pair of hearings. Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said, quote, "We can't have business as usual when Republicans are destroying the institution," unquote. He's worried for the future of the chamber.
How can we trust each other if when push comes to shove, when the stakes are the highest, the other side will double-cross their own standards?
The late Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg lies in state at the U.S. Capitol today and tomorrow. An unusual honor for a justice. Historically, it's been reserved for presidents, military commanders, and members of Congress. Yesterday was National Voter Registration Day. Younger voters between the age of 18 and 39 are the largest potential voting bloc.
A big focus for us right now with these voter registration deadlines looming in a lot of states is making a big final push toward getting every young voter possible registered.
Historically, they haven't turned out. Alex Leishinger with NextGen America hopes to reverse that trend.
As much as possible as we can close that gap means that young people are able to recognize their power at the polling place.
In Florida, for the first time, people with past felony convictions can vote in a presidential election, but there's another hurdle. Before registering to vote, they must pay back all their court fees and fines. That's about $25 million statewide. The Florida Rights Restoration Coalition has raised $20 million so far. $16 million of that from former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg's donors and supporters. Basketball stars LeBron James and Michael Jordan, musician John Legend, and filmmaker Steven Spielberg also got involved. Here's the coalition's founder, Desmond Mead.
Every bit of the money that they donate goes towards paying off fines and fees for individuals, and we're putting a lot of our focus on marginalized communities, Black and brown bodies who suffered from racism, who suffered from COVID, who suffered from the over-policing.
The Presidential Debate Commission yesterday announced topics for next week's debate: the candidates' records, the pandemic, the economy, race and violence in cities, election integrity, and the Supreme Court. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
Minnesota groups are calling for elected officials to represent voters, not themselves. Mike Moen with the Public News Service has the story.
Minnesota has seen many seldom heard voices come to the forefront in 2020, and many more hope to catch the attention of policymakers and political candidates with an event in St. Paul today. Nearly 20 advocacy groups are celebrating voters from diverse backgrounds, and they say it's time for elected officials to take them seriously. Their march to the state capitol aims to send a message at a time when political divisiveness grips the region. Minister Janae Bates of the group Faith in Minnesota says with the pandemic and the police killing of George Floyd, there's a stronger sense to speak up.
Minnesotans all across the state of every race and region and religion have really started to awaken to the fact that things have to change and that we can actually be the ones to change it.
Organizers hope that by energizing voters, they can help to usher in leadership that takes a realistic look at the needs of all communities without political gamesmanship. Bates says the message is aimed at all political parties. Social distancing and other safety guidelines have been advised for the event. Bates says they also don't want leaders who stoke tensions over such issues such as public safety in urban areas. She says pitting communities against each other only leads to more anger, not solutions.
We organize people in the cities, in the metro, in the suburbs, and in greater Minnesota. And what we're finding is that all of these folks have similar problems. The things that are different is that we're being told different people to point the blame at.
Minnesota doesn't have a race for governor this year, but state legislative seats are up for grabs, and there's a hotly contested U.S. Senate race, as well as elections in congressional districts. Mike Moen, Public News Service.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael still isn't sure it's safe to breathe deeply.
The day Portland's air stopped being hazardous, Ruth Bader Ginsburg died, making the whole country's future hazardous. Don't know what kind of mask protects from hopelessness, rage, and paranoia, but I probably can't afford it. Yesterday, the U.S. reached 200,000 COVID deaths, 20% of the world's total, with only 4% of the world's population, and Trump says we'd be doing so much worse if not for him. Even without the equinox, every day is getting darker. Can you be a hypocrite when everything you say is a lie? Can you be a democracy when the people's only way to participate, the vote, keeps being systematically denied by supporters of this president who says he can only lose if the election is rigged when he knows a rigged election is the only kind he can win? 2 days before the vote is when they move the clocks back. The darkest hour may be just before the power goes out. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You are listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael, Hendrik Brokelschen, and Nat Moon. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Antonia Gonzalez, Anthony Lizowitz, Mike Moen, Suzanne Potter, and Andrea Sears. Our evening news director is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Juneteenth Radio, reporting on the latest stories in African American and Black society. At 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, it's Between the Covers, featuring an interview with Mary Kim Arnold, author of The Fish and the Dove. Then at 11:30, tune in for Words and Pictures. Tomorrow, they'll be discussing drive-in theaters in the time of COVID. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. We are currently in our fall membership drive, so if you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in depth. Thank you.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Today on KBOO News In Depth, we will be listening in to the launch of the Yes for Police Accountability campaign. The campaign is about Portland ballot measure 26217. If passed, the ballot measure would create a new police oversight board by amending the city charter. The new oversight board would have unprecedented power to investigate complaints against the Portland Police Bureau. They would be able to subpoena witnesses and request police documents. They could also impose discipline, including firing officers who break the law. Currently, the oversight system doesn't have that much power, which makes change difficult for those who want to see police held accountable for their actions, especially when it comes to the treatment of Black and Brown people and people experiencing mental illness. The first to speak is Portland City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty.
All right. I first want to start by thanking you all for joining us today. We are very, very excited about this community-driven campaign around creating a model of community oversight of policing. We're going to start with Reverend Monine, who is currently the president of the NAACP Portland branch, among many other things. Reverend Monine, kick us off, please.
Good morning. We here in Portland and the uprising that we see, like in many other cities across the country, is direct consequence of the racism, bigotry, violence, and subjugation against Black people that has fostered and festered for far too long in this country. The murder of George Floyd and the subsequent lack of accountability by the police has set into motion what we can only describe as a moment of reckoning for our nation's consciousness. We are seeking to see police accountability at the highest level that it's ever been. And I think that we in our community have an opportunity to get that done now like we've never done, like we never had in the history of our country. 57 years have gone by since the Voters' Rights Act and the Bill of Rights, the Civil Rights Act, and we are still seeing disproportionate numbers in the Department of Justice where it concerns African Americans and our constituencies. We're calling for action now. And we know that we are the people that can do it. We are here asking for police reform, police accountability, and a greater structure where it concerns African American people and fairness in our policing.
Thank you so much, Reverend Monine. We're gonna now go to Dr. Reverend Leroy Haynes, who is the co-chair of the Albina Ministerial Alliance Coalition for Justice and Police Reform.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. As the Commissioner stated, I am the Reverend Dr. Leroy Haynes, chairperson of the Albina Ministerial Alliance Coalition for Justice and Police Reform. Since the year 2003, the AMA Coalition for Justice and Police Reform has demanded the creation of an independent citizen police oversight board with the power to subpoena and compel officers to testify. This happened following the outrageous killing of an unarmed Black woman named Kendra James. That was just a senseless killing of her by a Portland police officer. Over 5,000 people gathered together in the Northeast and marching, calling for reform at that time. Since that time, the MA Coalition has led major protests over two decades calling for a reform, working on different committees in City Hall and making changes in training policies and practice. We initiated the MA Coalition, the call for the U.S. Department of Justice under the Obama administration to order Portland Police Bureau that led to the settlement agreement with the city of Portland where we were given the legal status of enhanced courier amicus by the federal court. Throughout these many efforts and through the many different deaths that have taken place, James Jahar Perez, 2004, James Chassie, 2006, Aaron Campbell, 2010, Keaton Otis, in 2010. Throughout these many and many since that time of deaths, we still have not been able to stop the killing of unarmed people by the Portland Police Bureau. The findings of an audit that took place by the U.S. Department of Justice was that the Portland Police Bureau used excessive and deadly force against mentally ill persons or persons perceived with mentally illness. Furthermore, the Department of Justice described the oversight system in Portland as Byzantine, 5th century. Hence, the AMA Coalition for Justice and Police Reform fully support the proposed ballot initiative as a transformation foundation for producing true police accountability in our city. We have an opportunity in this city to create a model for the whole nation in police accountability in this ballot initiative. That Black and brown people and mentally ill persons or persons perceived to be with mentally ill, that their lives matter, that Black lives matter, that brown lives matter, that the mentally ill lives matter. Dr. Martin Luther King would have called this moment the urgent now. It is now, not later, that we need to address the issue of police accountability. And with that, the AMA Coalition will bring out its troops and support this effort in whatever is needed to be done. I call upon every citizen in the city of Portland that believe in the sacredness of life, that believe in justice, that believe in righteousness. This is your hour and your time with the passes of this particular ballot initiative. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. We're grateful that you are part of our team. Next, we're going to go to Maria Cahill, and she's with the Pacific Northwest Family Circle.
Thanks, Joanne. Before I get started here, I want to acknowledge the leadership of the other speakers today. Collectively, and maybe even individually, you have been supporting families for longer than I've been alive, and I just turned 50 this year. So I just want to express my deep gratitude and respect for you and your commitment to this community. I'm honored to speak today on behalf of Pacific Northwest Family Circle, a group of racially and politically diverse families whose loved ones were killed by police. They work together to educate the public and change laws and policies. Pacific Northwest Family Circle endorses the Yes for Real Police Accountability measure. Families believe that this historic initiative can create a fair, truly independent, empowered, and funded police oversight board. I've worked with and followed the leadership of family members from the very first day of this organization. I'm always curious to hear families' personal stories. Despite the different situations in which their loved ones were killed, I've noticed in Portland and across Oregon and Washington, their experiences are surprisingly consistent. Their loved ones' reputations are smeared by the media. Police want people to believe that loved ones need to be killed to keep the community safe, even though there are cities and whole countries where police go many months and sometimes years without killing a single person who lives there. The criminal legal system blames loved ones for their own death. For example, 19-year-old loved one Christopher Kalonji's death was ruled a homicide, but his death certificate says suicide. And during secret grand jury proceedings, personal information about loved ones is often presented to the jury to bias them against loved ones. It's very difficult to get information from the district attorney and others in the criminal legal system. And finally, families who refuse to stay silent, like the courageous families of Pacific Northwest Family Circle, suffer regularly from police intimidation. Police drive by their houses or park outside them in marked cars, perhaps to cast doubt on neighbors' minds. They go to their workplaces too. Police follow them through town as they drive home or for many, many miles to the next town. In 100% of the cases of loved ones being killed by police, the criminal legal system finds police officers' actions justified. This means officers are either not disciplined or their discipline is overturned. And in fact, the opposite of discipline, police are often promoted. It's also common for police to be awarded medals of valor, even when they shoot people in the back while running away, as they did to 22-year-old loved one Bodie Phelps. If a third party investigates the cases, as they do in Portland, and finds misconduct while killing a loved one, officers still aren't punished. I offer you two examples. On February 9th, 2017, officers cornered 17-year-old loved one Moose Hayes, known in death as Quanis Hayes, in a southeast neighborhood yard. The supervisor, Officer Andrew Hurst, was acting in the capacity of an unsupervised police officer. This led to four police officers yelling conflicting commands at Moose. They were found to violate Portland Police Bureau policies, and their actions were found to cause Moose's murder. 3 months later, almost to the day, Officer Ajir responded to a disturbance at a TriMet MAC station in southeast Portland. He ran after 24-year-old Terrell Johnson. With no way to look through the sight of his gun as he was falling down, Officer Ajir pulled the trigger. The OIR group found that Officer Ajir violated the Portland Police Bureau chase policy. At least 44 people have been killed by police in Portland since Kendra James was killed 17 years ago. At least 380 people in Oregon in the last 28 years. One story could be discounted, but these are many stories telling me the same thing. It doesn't seem to matter if there are good cops and bad cops. The system consistently protects all police the same, doing so at the expense of loved ones and families and the community. Currently, community-led boards in Portland aren't allowed to consider excessive force cases. The current system requires police to investigate and discipline themselves and allows them to do this in private. Family members agree police violence can happen to anyone and no one should be killed by police. The way to prevent more people being unnecessarily harmed and killed by police is to hold them accountable through more transparent systems. Today, I am asking you to put aside all the things you don't know about police and the policing system and trust the lived experience and leadership of families as I do. Family members support this ballot measure and ask you to vote yes for real police accountability. Thank you for this time today.
Thank you so much, Maria. Next, we're gonna hear from Jennifer Williamson, formerly with the Oregon Legislature and now with the ACLU of Oregon.
Hi, thank you, Commissioner Hardesty. I want to join Maria in just saying thank you to the members of this panel for their leadership in our community for decades. And it is my honor to be on this panel with all of you, so thank you. As the commissioner said, I'm Jennifer Williamson. I'm a former legislator, former judiciary chair in the House, and former majority leader. One thing that I've done for the last 20 years, as many of you know, is work on criminal justice reform, picking up the baton from the commissioner and then passing it on to current legislators, including folks on the Transparency and Policing and Use of Force Committee, as they look at systemic changes in policing in this state. In Salem, we've looked at police training, use of force, civil liability and civil immunity for police officers, racial disparities in the system. We've collected data, whether it's profiling data or the way that people are treated in our jail and prison system. And over again, we see racial disparities. And policing is the front door of our criminal justice system, and our racial disparities start there. I am a huge supporter of this ballot measure, and I am because policing is ultimately local. And we can do lots in Salem to try to address these issues, but we're looking at a larger system, and what works for Portland is not necessarily going to work for Pendleton. So we need to take a localized approach to the way that we hold our officers accountable for the way they interact with our communities. this is a sound ballot measure. We know that there will be lawsuits because this is a first of its kind in the nation oversight committee. And so we know in this environment that there'll be lawsuits. We can see the way in which our police unions are dealing with our current district attorney as he tries new and different ways to interact with our community. So we know that this ballot measure will be challenged. And I am confident that the way it's structured, it will withstand a challenge or any sort of lawsuit, including with the US Department of Justice as it currently stands and their fixation with Portland. I just think this is such an innovative way to bring accountability to our officers and bring transparency to our system. And I am a supporter, a enthusiastic supporter of this ballot measure. And I'm here to say that this is just not something that we can address in Salem. It has to be addressed at our local level. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, thank you all for those very inspirational words.
That was an excerpt from the launch of the Yes for Police Accountability campaign regarding Portland ballot measure 26217. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings. Coming up next is News from the Boo, your look at the news inside KBOO.
And now it's